Hello, everybody, and welcome to the second episode of Scott Bradley's podcast at scottbradley.name. Really looking forward to today's guest. Let me tell you a little bit about him. His name's MJ DeMarco, and he's the recent author of The Millionaire Fastlane. And as a previous owner of Limos, creator and owner of Limos.com, ended up making that company massively successful. He's also an entrepreneur with many other ventures, and really looking forward to having him today. MJ, welcome to the call.
Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, thanks so much for doing. Hey, no problem at all. So MJ, you know, you wrote this book, and everything's been going relatively well since you've written. You know, you created your publishing company, you wrote the book. But before we get into that, if the listeners haven't heard from you or don't know who you are, I just want to give you a little bit of a chance to share your story, to kind of give people a framework of where you're coming from, so then all the previous later questions, things can just flow easier, if you know what I'm saying.
Sure. You want the early history from when I was a teen or something a little bit more of the recent stuff?
Probably kind of very similar to the story that you write in your book, as far as, you know, you're probably from Chicago and the move into Phoenix.
Oh, okay. Well, I grew up in a single-parent household. Kind of was an environment where, you know, the bills weren't always paid, you know, it was hard to get food on the table, and that kind of set me up into a mentality where, you know, I didn't want to live like that for the rest of my life. So I was always interested in, you know, finding ways to create wealth, and, you know, my preconception on it was that you had to be famous. You had to become an actor, you had to become an actress, you had to become a professional athlete, you know, play baseball or something. You know, if you ever wanted a chance to become wealthy young, that's the road you got to take.
Of course.
So, you know, early on, I pretty much gave up on that idea because I was, you know, to be blunt, kind of a fat kid. I was unmotivated. I was lazy. But one day, something changed, and it happened when I was heading to the ice cream store. And, you know, being an overweight kid, I loved ice cream, so that was a kind of a regular thing for me. But outside the ice cream store was a Lamborghini Countach. And if you're not familiar with that car, it's the old Cannonball Run car with the doors that go up, and it's fast, and it's like a, you know, $200,000 car. And this was back in the, you know, late 80s, so.
Yep.
So when I saw that car, I was just, you know, it just was amazing. It was something that was on my walls with posters. I was always drooling over it in the magazines. And my first thought about it was, okay, well, this is going to be some old guy that owns it. And the guy that came out of the store was a young guy and totally violated what I thought, you know, who would own that type of car. And I made the decision at that point to go up to the guy and ask him what he did for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was an inventor. And that totally violated everything I thought he would have said. I would have thought he said he was a baseball player or, you know, he's an actor or something famous I was expecting.
Mm-hmm.
So it totally violated my preconception on, you know, on that idea. And it set me off on a path to become an entrepreneur. It made me realize that, you know what, you can become wealthy, and you don't have to be famous. You can do it via entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I made a decision. One day, I am going to own a Lamborghini, and I'm going to do it young. I'm not going to wait till I'm old. I'm going to do it young. I also decided that I would follow a career path of entrepreneurship. Now, this was when I was, I don't know, 12, 13 years old. And
nice.
So it started really early. And the ironic thing is today, when I'm driving around in my Lamborghini, the most frequent question I get is the exact same question I asked those many years ago. It's, hey, what do you do? Or what do you do for a living? Can I do what you do? So now I have an opportunity to actually, instead of just saying, oh, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, I can actually reach in my car and give a book out. So that's kind of how this all evolved.
Love it. Love it. And briefly, one of the things that I really stuck out to me in your book was how you made that trek, and there was that point on that cold Chicago night when you're sitting in your limo, which is what you were doing at the time, and mm-hmm. when you came to that realization of my life can be better than this. And just share with the listeners kind of that part of your story where it was that was like your breaking point, and it's like, I got to make some changes here and move and get in an environment where I can actually go towards my goals rather than, you know, sitting in my life that I'm not happy with. Kind of what happened from that point?
Yeah, I mean, my success definitely was not overnight. I graduated from college with a marketing degree and a finance degree, struggled in business venture after business venture after college, probably for about 5 or 6 years. I mean, I was 26 years old, living at home with mom, and I just had a litany, long laundry list of garbage jobs that would pretty much embarrass anybody, from, you know, picking up dog crap, delivering newspapers at 3 in the morning, delivering pizza. And one of those jobs was a limousine driver. And I remember the night. I was on the road, and there was a snowstorm. And I couldn't get anywhere because I was way out in the boondocks. And I just pulled to the side of the road and turned the car off, and it was cold in the car. And I was just sitting there looking at the ceiling and just thinking to myself, you know, this can't be my life. It's something, you know, something has got to change. And it hit me that I was sitting there in that limousine based on my choices. My choices led me to that point at that very moment. And it struck me that I didn't have to live in Chicago anymore. I mean, I was seasonal depressed. I needed sun to survive. And it never occurred to me that I can just move. I can just pick up, get out of Chicago, and go to somewhere that was sunny, some place that was, you know, an environment that would motivate me and to compel me to, you know, do what needed to be done. So at that moment, that's another life-changing event that happened in my life. And mm-hmm. I'd say about 3 weeks later, I ended up moving. I got the heck out of Chicago, moved down to Phoenix, came down here with just a couple $100s, small studio apartment, no job, no friends, no family, nothing. But it was probably the happiest day of my life.
Awesome, awesome. Well, it's definitely an inspiring story. And again, you talk a lot more about it in your book in detail, but for the sake of time here, definitely want to get into your book. So as you share in your book, you know, you came into Phoenix with $900 in your pocket. And I remember there's a point in your book where you talk about, I felt so in control of my life, even though I was, you know, basically living with almost nothing. And mm-hmm. I want to kind of move into, you know, how you chose where to spend your time in order to start taking control and moving forward. And there's something in your book that you talk about where you are of the adage that you do not believe of doing what you love and the money will follow. And I want you to kind of share with the listeners that are listening to this what your adage is and kind of how you think about, okay, I know I want to start a business, I know I want to be an entrepreneur, but figuring out what's that first action to take. So kind of expanding upon that, you know, kind of crossing through that doing what you love and all that stuff.
Well, I think entrepreneurship has been perversed, and it's being perversed by gurus. If you read my book, anyone will tell you that I'm pretty anti-guru in there.
Yes.
And it's because we got gurus who are out there saying, do what you love and the money's going to follow. Follow your passion, lifestyle design, and all these things, these mentalities, they're all selfishly based. And they're not based on anything particular in the marketplace.
Right.
And the marketplace is the ultimate judge and jury of what you have to offer if it has value. Because if it has value, people open up their wallets and they give you money. Now, the problem with do what you love is no one cares about what you love. I mean, we live in a pretty selfish world. I mean, if you read my book and you loved it and it changed your life, do you really care that I loved writing it? Do you care that I hated writing it? It doesn't make a difference to you. You just want to know, hey, could this book change my life? Hey, could your product make my life easier? Hey, does this fix something in my life? That's ultimately what people want to know. Now, I failed for the first 5 years after college in business because I was listening to that crap advice, doing what you love. And I tried doing what I love several times, and in both instances, they failed because the market simply didn't need what I had to offer. In addition, I wasn't good enough at it. See, for do what you love to work, number one, there has to be a need, fundamental need for what you offer, and you have to be good at it. I mean, I love to play piano. I suck at it. I love to play baseball. I suck at it. There's a lot of things I love to do, but I'm just not good enough at it.
Yep. Understand. So, and I'll let you finish. Yep.
My advice is you got to start approaching the market based on a market-based approach, meaning what is in the market that is needed, not as opposed to what do you need.
You know, that's really a great point that you bring up there. And, you know, you did mention in your answer that, you know, for the first 5 years, you failed. And I'm sure throughout those first 5 years of, again, following the adage of doing what you love, so on and so forth, and kind of going through the trenches of all the processes that you probably figured out that didn't work or, you know, led you down the wrong path, what were some of the mistakes that you feel that you made in those first 5 years when you were kind of trying to reach that success and getting that Lamborghini at a young age, kind of like you kind of walked throughout your entire book? What were some of the mistakes?
First mistake I would say is thinking that you have a limit on how much you can earn. I mean, I remember the time when I thought $10,000, you know, profiting $10,000 a month was just a lot of money. And for me, that thought to me was a limiting barrier. And I remember that was only a mentally construed roadblock that I put in my head. The reality was I could make as much money as I wanted based on what kind of mathematical equation I was working under. When I say mathematical equation, any business that you get involved in is going to be governed by a mathematical equation, meaning how much wealth can you create, how much, what is the scalability of the opportunity. So that day came where, you know, hey, you know, I started making $15,000 a month, then it became to $30,000, then it became to $50,000 a month, then it was $100,000 a month, and ultimately it went above $200,000 per month. And that's when I realized that, oh my God, you can make whatever you want as long as you tap into the right mathematical equation. And to think, you know, I can only make, you know, X amount of dollars is basically a limited belief that's going to keep you trapped.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Any other mistakes that you kind of learned along the way as well?
Don't spend more money than you earned. And when I sold my company for the first time, I remember getting a $250,000 check, and I pretty much blew most of it. You know, I went out trying to look rich, and you know, before it was said and done, most of it was gone, and it didn't actually create wealth; it actually stole wealth. So, financial discipline doesn't really care what you make. If you're making, if you're spending more than you're earning, you know, you're ultimately going to get a detour that's not going to be likened.
Definitely, definitely. Now, that actually leads in right into my next question. And you said that, you know, I just got the big check and I wanted to go look rich. And in your book, you talk about the three different lanes to go in. You got the fast lane, you got the slow lane, and you got the sidewalk. And I thought the way you set it up was just so brilliant from a mindset of this was this mindset, that mindset, and that mindset. So I'd love for you to kind of expand upon what it means to be fast lane, what it means to be slow lane, and what does it mean to be on the sidewalk looking at everything else? Because I felt that was really valuable in what you shared in your book.
Sure. The sidewalk is probably a place that we've all been. I know certainly I have. It's a place where you have no financial plan. It's just you live paycheck to paycheck. Anything you earn is spent on, you know, whatever great gadget you can find, nice clothes. A lot of sidewalkers actually look rich, but they're, you know, one blown financial gasket away from being in bankruptcy or living back with their parents. The sidewalk is just no discipline, no financial discipline, no financial knowledge, and everything you earn is ultimately spent on an image or just to pay the bills or whatever.
Now that's also including certain. Now that's also not to cut you off, but that's also concerning celebrities who are making the $1 million income,
oh,
right?
Oh, sure, and that's one of the things about the sidewalk is you can be a business owner, you can be a celebrity. I mean, when you hear an NBA athlete who goes broke, you know, 3-4 years after their latest huge contract, that's the sidewalk. That's I'm spending more than I'm earning. And then, like I said, it doesn't care what you're making or what your business or what your gig is. The fundamental basis is you have an income and you are spending more than that income. So that's the nutshell of the sidewalk. The slow lane is a more disciplined approach, and it's what we've been indoctrinated to follow. It's the old get a job, go to school, save 10% of your paycheck, live mindlessly frugal for 40, 50 years, and then one day when you're, you know, I don't know, 65, 70 years old, you're going to retire rich. That's the old slow lane. And it's a pathetically, I mean, it has discipline, so it's a big improvement, but it's a financial plan that is dubiously predicated on hope and time. And it's hope because, you know, if you don't have a job, the plan is going to fail. If you can't find a job, the plan's going to fail. If the stock market loses 40, 50% of your money in 1 year, the plan fails. It is predicated on all kinds of things that you cannot control nor leverage. You can't leverage time. You can't leverage stock market returns. I like to say it's an impotent financial plan. And unfortunately, most Americans follow that plan.
Yep, got it. Now the fast lane.
The fast lane swaps out what I just described in the slow lane from hope and time to control and leverage. It is about a psychological, mathematical, and business strategy that is focused on entrepreneurship and putting value into the marketplace that can be scaled exponentially and controlled. And that's pretty much what I did. And when I say leverage, I know leverage is a word that sometimes can scare people. I'm not talking about risky business loans or real estate loans. I'm talking about scalable assets. And for example, when I owned my website, 20,000-30,000 people sometimes would visit daily. That was a scalable metric that could go into the hundreds of thousands. I wrote this book. This book, I could print 1 million copies. It's a scalable asset. And that's the nutshell. The fast lane is scalable, leverageable business assets that you can control.
Awesome. Well, that's a really great description. And, you know, in the fast lane and kind of in your book again throughout, you talk about, you know, following and building your control, building the leverage into your business. And it really comes down to, you know, following a process versus, you know, where the media, you know, you kind of use the example that in all of American business today and all the big stores, you only see the main big hit, but you fail to see, you know, the process that the people took in order to get to that. So I'd love for you to kind of share, you know, a little bit about your processes that you went through to, you know, when you started your company to kind of you selling it and kind of the overview of what you learned in just that experience.
Sure. I think a lot of business success has to do with recognizing the process and the expectations that you're going to have. We are an event-driven society, and by event-driven means we like to look at the event. When a athlete, you know, gets a $100 million contract, we look at that, and that's the event. When, you know, someone sells their technology company for $50 million, that makes news all across the internet. That's the event. People tend not to look at the process that went into that event. I like to say process or events are the residue of process. Process is what you do not see. Process is, like in my case, was I don't know how many times I had to say no to my friends who wanted to go out drinking on Friday night. No, I stayed home and I was regurgitating code. I don't know how many times I was sitting in the library reading books on HTML and JavaScript and XML while, you know, I could easily be at home watching American Idol. I was driving a piece of crap car without a transmission and wouldn't go into fourth gear, so I can only go 45 miles per hour. People don't see that. That's the process. That's the backstory. That's the hard work. And if you engage this entrepreneurial process knowing that you're going to have a process like that probably. There's going to be some sacrifices. There's going to be some failure stories. There's going to be a lot of issues that come up because those events, the ones that you hear about, don't come unless you have a process beforehand. And the process is the story. It's your unfolding story. And even in this, even while I'm trying to market this book, I see that I see this process thing come up. I mean, it's just it's a long process. It's about hundreds, if not thousands, of hard choices that string together and create a lifestyle. They create the process. And think of it as like losing weight. You can't make a decision and lose weight. It has to happen concertatively. Over and over and over, over and over, and then ultimately you eventually lose weight. That's the process.
Exactly, exactly. Well, that's really, I think out of all the things in your book between, you know, focusing on building the process and following the right process, and the framework that you kind of, the fast lane rules of, you know, before you jump into business, kind of, it has to make sure it crosses all those check marks, and you use have like a special system that you kind of take all businesses through before it's like, yep, this is right, I'm going to jump in and focus. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about what that is, and obviously it's going to be all detailed in your book, but just kind of give listeners a taste of kind of where your entrepreneurial framework is coming from, and I'm referring to the next strategy. So I'd just love for you to kind of share a little bit about that.
Okay, the fast lane has a series of commandments, I call them, and there's five of them. Basically, it's kind of a litmus test to determine, you know, is this a business that could scale exponentially? You know, make me a millionaire in a couple years. Is this a business that I could sell for a multi-million dollar valuation? And there's a series of commandments that you can put your opportunity or business through to determine if that's valid. Or you can, you know, look at them and say, okay, well, I'm weak on this one, and I need to address that. So I call it the next framework. It's NECST. It's pronounced next, but that's spelled that way. And the five are need, entry, control, scale, and time. The first is need, and obviously that's what I talked about a little bit earlier, is about, you know, engage the marketplace with something that it needs, not with what your own selfish desires are. Engage with what the market needs. The second one is entry. And this is one where a lot of people just totally fall off the cliff. If what you're doing can be started by anyone else within 10 minutes, it's not something you want to be doing. Because what you're doing is you're entering a market space that's going to be crowded. I mean, I think the example I use in my book is, if you know the bum outside the back of the Chinese restaurant sleeping on the next to the dumpster can start what you're doing in 10 minutes, it's not something you want to do. And it's because it's supply-demand.
Yes.
The third is control. And with this is you want to be able to control all aspects of your business. And when I say control, I mean everything from research and development, pricing, product, labeling, everything relative to owning a business you want to control. This is where a lot of people totally, I would say most entrepreneurs totally fall off. They join network marketing companies where the hierarchical decisions are made by a control structure, or they join affiliate programs where an affiliate person can say, I'm changing the terms on you, or you know, there's some kind of structure that can totally slip the rug out from under you. That's not what you want to do. And then to give you an example is, I had affiliates that would sell for me, and I my best affiliate routinely made $20,000, $30,000 a month. Yep. Well, at any moment, I could have said, hey, you know what? I'm changing things up. I'm going to change your pay. I'm going to change this. I'm going to change that. And he would have been stuck to it. So that's control. You want to control your business, all aspects of it. The fourth one is scale, and we kind of talked about that. That's leveraged business assets. Can your business scale? Can it impact the lives of millions? If you buy a sandwich franchise and you start selling sandwiches on the corner of Elm Street and Maple, I'm sorry, but that business cannot scale. You cannot serve 20,000 sandwiches in one day. It's not a scalable business. So you have to do a lot of manipulation on that commandment in order to create a leveraged opportunity. And the final one is time. Eventually, can you pull yourself away from the business so you're making money while you're doing something else, while you're laying on the beach, while you're sleeping, while you're sick, while you're gambling? Can you create a surrogate entity that can take place of your time trade, because the slowing is about a time trade. It's about, you know, I'm an accountant, I make $100,000 a year. It's a time trade. The commandment of time within the fast lane is how do you get your business to surrogate for the time trade, so you're earning money while you are actually not engaged in the business. So that sums up need, entry, control, scale, and time. Those are the five fast lane commandments.
Definitely. And I have to say that out of probably all the things in your book, that was those commandments probably were one of the things that gave me the most clarity for me personally, that just stuck out to me like a sore thumb. Like, oh my God, that's where I was getting it wrong all the time. So just want to give you mad props for that. That was just, man, awesome information. So kind of wrapping up here, coming to the next question, as you were going through the next strategy, you were talking about, you know, I want to build a company to scale to millions, serve millions, and then with a potential exit strategy of, you know, selling your company for millions. Now, let me ask you this, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are thinking about this as well. It's like, okay, I build my company, I follow the fast lane commandments, I get my million-dollar valuation, and I sell it. From that point, I mean, how do you invest that money? Do you go and start another business? Do you, you know, put in the stock market? What's the strategy, and how do you see that event and that part of the process? At that point, what decisions do you feel like you have to make in order to not only continue to grow wealth, but even more so continue the cash flow on a monthly basis that's at the fast lane level?
Well, it's going to depend on each individual person. Usually a monogamous business that scales to multi-million dollar event and you ultimately sell it, those people actually go on and become angel investors in other companies. It's like their monogamous business produces a polygamous investment strategy where they're out investing in multiple companies. I mean, how many times have you heard, you know, some tech entrepreneur sells his company for millions, and then all of a sudden he's partners in 10 different other companies.
Yep.
So, I mean, it really depends on the individual. You can put another destination, the fast lane, is to have a lump sum amount of money that could cash flow just by having interest income, and that's kind of what I do. I've invested heavily in the Australian dollar, which yields 4%.
Yep.
And, you know, so it really depends on where the person wants to go. I've been, I've been retired about 4 years now. So, you know, and during that period, I chose to write this book. I thought it needed to be written. So that's what I did in my retirement. So the answer to your question is going to depend on each individual person. I haven't gone out and spread my wings, so to speak, and, you know, become this huge angel investor. It's not something something that I really wanted to do. I kind of caught up on, you know, I wanted to play video games. I didn't do while I was building my company. I kind of caught up in the last 3 years. But
well, that's good. Well, it's nice to step back and enjoy and be able to look at all your hard work and say, hey, I created this. Now I get to finally, you know, enjoy it, and, you know, then decide, okay, I've spent time enjoying it. What's next? And you know, in selling your company for multi-millions and having that freedom of choice, I think is something that was themes throughout the book that I felt, wow, this is really awesome how it was positioned, how it was delivered. And it almost felt like your entire book was a step-by-step process. And I think, you know, throughout the book you made it very clear, look, you know, if you want to do this, it's going to be hard. You know, it's going to be tough. You're going to deal with roadblocks. You're going to have to go through all these challenges, but it's all worth it in the end, because the lifestyle you have at the end of the tunnel, it's so worth all the time you put in. So awesome stuff.
Not even the lifestyle after. It's the lifestyle during, and I think I mentioned that during my book, is just the ability to have control over your financial plan. You know, to have some control to know that, you know what, I can make decisions here. I'm not going to be laid off next week because of the economy. Or, you know, you get a certain sense of control. And I tell you, that in itself makes, I don't know about other people, but it makes me happy.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the grunt work that you have to do as entrepreneurs. So I think putting people in control of their financial plan, it has tremendous dividends in terms of, you know, personal happiness.
definitely, definitely. So I have one more question for you, MJ. One last thing that you talk about in your book is always all about surrounding yourself with the right information and positive people. And I'd love to, you know, hear from you, what are some of your favorite books that you've read, and ideally, what certain tips can you give some people to find the right people to connect with and network with? Because I do know that you have the Fastlane Forum, and I'd love to have you share a little bit about that before we close things up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I believe surrounding yourself with positive people, because this Fastlane strategy goes against everything that society knows. So when you do something different that society is not used to seeing, you're going to encounter headwinds. You're going to encounter haters. You're going to encounter people that say, oh, that can't be done, or, oh, why are you doing that? Oh, why are you wasting another weekend coding? I mean, you're going to get headwinds. So I like to say, you know, you have to surround yourself with people who kind of subscribe to the same mindset that will empower you to become a better person. I know a lot of people hang around with habitual negative thinkers, and they bring them down. And these people ultimately end up, they're like roads. I mean, if you're constantly hanging out with a guy that's, you know, smoking dope, getting high on the weekends, passes out drunk, steals from the convenience store, that's a road you are on. You are passengering in on that road. And that could lead you down to a dangerous path that you don't want to take. So I like to say, you know what, look at who's in your life and start getting around people that are going to empower you to be the best person you can be. Now, the Fastlane Forum is an entrepreneur forum that I created that has people that subscribe to this Fastlane strategy. It's a free forum, so it's available to anyone. And what was the other question? Oh, about books.
Yeah, about books. Any books that you like feel that were really impactful to your journey as you've kind of gone through this whole process of following all the Fastlane strategies going forward?
The one that got me through the dark days was probably Tony Robbins' Awaken the Giant Within. It's a huge book, kind of old. A lot of mental psychology things in there. And whenever things were going down for me, I would, you know, peek my head into that book. Another book that I really loved, and it's probably a book that no one's ever heard of, but it was something that I totally resonated with me. And it's actually something that is the closest thing I could ever find to a Fastlane ideology, and it was called What Rich People Know and Desperately Want to Keep Secret. I think it's by Brian Shear. And it's probably about 10 years old. It's a small book, but it was just a book that just made total sense to me. And if anyone's read my book and needs like more Fastlane, that's the type of book I would recommend for you to pick up.
Awesome, awesome. Well, MJ, I've had a really great time interviewing you. Want to give you the opportunity to share with the listeners where they can find you, where they can find your book, and then I'll just close it out.
Great. It's The Millionaire Fastlane, Crack the Code to Wealth, Live Rich for a Lifetime. It is on Amazon, Amazon Kindle, iBooks if you have an iPad or an iPhone, and also Nook. And so far, the reviews have been great. If you have more questions about it, you need to look into it further, check out the reviews, see what other people are saying about it.
And where can people find you if they want to connect with you on social media?
Twitter, MJ DeMarco.
Okay.
FastlaneForum.com and MJ DeMarco on Facebook, all pretty much searchable on that.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, MJ, thank you so much for taking the time. This has been really awesome. You shared a ton of value with all the listeners. And if you are listening to this, highly recommend. I've read MJ's book, put my stamp of approval on it, and you're going to get a ton of value from it. So, thank you so much for your time, MJ. Hope you have a great rest of the day. And thank you, listeners. This is, you know, closing up the second episode of Scott Bradley's podcast. Hope you all have a great day, and bye for now.